grateful once again to have the flag on the staff and to be able to salute the flag on Sunday morning in recognition of the freedom we have that has been purchased for us by our military establishment. We have a lot of problems in this country, and we have a lot of things that go on a weekly basis. Over time, I used to bring a lot of current event type things to the pulpit. Some pastors' ministries are almost entirely in current events. It's very difficult not to express opinion, especially when you're me, because I'm a very opinionated person. But I have been trying to hold it down to a minimum, and I purposely have not tried to say much about some of the current things that go on in the country. Quite frankly, my thinking has really changed on some of those things. Not that it's changed for or against them. It still is the way it used to be. It's just they're not as important as they used to be. And my time is so filled with other things and with very important things. I was telling Cindy just this week, while she may not know it, and I don't think she does, and I certainly know that you don't know it, I'm probably going through one of the most difficult study periods of my ministry right now. And it just has to do with the nature of not just what I'm studying, but the method of studying. And it's almost like a taking the training wheels off type thing. And it is very personally, anyway, a very difficult period, although it's a very exciting period in my own growth and my own life and my own ability to take the Bible and to study it and to appreciate it. But along the lines of some of the things that have been going on in the country with the many things that our president is having to deal with, and I have watched some of the proceedings of the nomination of the Supreme Court Justice. I just get interested in the proceedings, and sometimes it's kind of like watching a recruit that's not even out of boot camp yet trying to examine George Patton to see if he's worthy of being a general. But it's fun, it's entertaining. I think it's more entertaining than any reality show that I know of. But as far as some of the other things, I'm not going to say anything really about it, because I find it to be more of a waste of time than profitable. But I would advise that, especially given the latest issues that have taken place with the hurricane victims and all of this kind of business, many years ago there was a congressman in the United States House of Representatives who was a very famous man, but yet he was also a very poor man. And everyone has heard of him. Boys try to emulate him. He was Congressman Davy Crockett. And when he was a congressman, there was an incident that arose where I believe it was a naval officer, had died prematurely, and the Congress was going to take up money appropriate funds for his widow. And before they were able to do it, Congressman Crockett stood up and he gave a long lecture to the House of Representatives. And the basic theme of that lecture was that when he was running for Congress, one of the times that he was getting reelected, he was back home in his native state and happened to talk to a farmer. And the farmer immediately knew who he was, even though Crockett didn't think he knew who he was, he did. And so he told him that he knew who he was and he knew why he was there. And he said, I just want you to know I'm not going to vote for you. And he said, you're not. He said, no. He said, I'll never vote for you again. And he said, I may be poor, I may be a dirt farmer, but I can read, and I am a citizen of the United States. And as a citizen of the United States, I know what the Constitution says. And there had come a house in Georgetown that had burned in Crockett's first term as a House a member of the House of Representatives. And it was a tragedy. And the house had burned down and left this family bereft and destitute and all of that. And the Congress had appropriated funds. They didn't take up a collection. They didn't do this through charity. They did it through appropriating funds. And Crockett was a part of that. And this man told him, he said, I know emotionally that that's the thing to do, but you have no right to take my money and appropriate it that way. And he said, for one real simple reason, it's not yours to give. And in fact, what they did the second time, when Crockett stood up and gave that lecture to the Congress, they took up a collection among themselves that superseded the appropriation they were going to give. And so all I'm going to say on it is my advice to you is to get that article. You can get it online. You can find it. Just do a search on Not Yours to Give. But if you can get a hold of that article, I have it in a book. That's about all I would have to say about that. And that reflects my opinion on the subject. We have, through this last administration, certainly turned corners that are going to redefine the country in some pretty radical ways. And it's going to be interesting. But like I said, my purpose here is not really to talk about current events or to go into some of these things or to prognosticate or any of those things. In fact, all of my predictions and prognostications always seem to fail. There's only been two that I've ever talked about. I used to try that because some of my colleagues used to do that. And there's only really been two that I was right on out of all the things that I used to talk about might happen to the country and all this. I was dead on right on the very day when Clinton was elected his first time. I said he'll get a second term. And I was right on that one. And many, many years ago, I mean before I ever came here, I once heard a screwy, goofy, insane genius, if you can correlate those two expressions, an insane genius, stand up with his little bow tie on and rant and rave about the blacks being the Jewish race, that Jesus was black, Adam was black because God created him from dirt. His name was Louis Farrakhan. Not very many people knew who he was at the time. And as I listened to that man speak, and this was back in the 80s, the very first time I ever heard him, I turned to Cindy and I told her, I said, one day we're going to have to fight these people. And I mean we're going to have to fight them with arms. We're going to have to take up arms against these people. And it was that radical Islam segment. And that's what we're doing today. So, if you know, even a blind squirrel finds a nut once in a while, and so if you keep saying things, making prognostications, you're bound to get one right once in a while, and so I got two right, and so I'm really out of the prognostication business. So don't come up and ask me what I think is going to happen to the country. I can tell you in general what's going to happen, but anybody, you know that. So I don't have any great insights into all of these things, but I just thought I'd point you, if you want to know what I think about it, go get the article that was written by Colonel Davy Crockett on It's Not Yours to Give, and that's pretty much my opinion on it. And that's all I have to say about that. But we are grateful that we have the freedom to be able to assemble this morning without the intervention of human government. And we're grateful that God has provided His words and has preserved His words to us in our Bibles this morning. And so for that principle, we always read the following. Hear the word of the Lord, ye that tremble at His word. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven, and returns not thither, but watereth the earth, and maketh it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereunto I sent it. Open the word of the Lord this morning to Romans chapter 5, verse 13. Romans chapter 5, verse 13. And you should have two new pages of class notes, page 82 and 83. So open your class notes to page 82. Continuing with the doctrine of the imputation of sin to the unbeliever by the ability of the law to do that. The law's ability to impute sin to the unbeliever. Following our customary procedure, the next few moments will be dedicated to silent prayer. A few moments of privacy and freedom to prepare in the usual manner for the study of the Word of God and laying aside the concerns and problems of your day, beginning to concentrate on the objective at hand. Therefore, in preparation this morning, let us pray. Heavenly Father, we are grateful to have the opportunity to come aside this morning and take in the mind of Christ, your very words that have been preserved, inerrant, and infallible to us this morning. We thank you that we can trust these words and have confidence that they will effectually work within us to produce godly thinking, living, and labor. And so as we continue to adjust to godliness and to have your thoughts develop within us, the conclusions that this doctrine is designed to give us, we ask for the wisdom, the clarity and the understanding and appreciation of these things, and that we might accurately and precisely handle your word, rightly dividing it so that we can have its greatest benefit. We ask these things not only to the edifying of our own souls, but we also ask it that your very words are the means by which Jesus Christ will both be honored and glorified, for we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen. Romans chapter 5, we're coming back here after we have been in Deuteronomy for quite some time, looking at some issues concerning the ability of law to impute sin, which is a doctrine Paul assumes that every person who is reading Romans 5:13 knows. And he expects that to be known. And I do have to beg the pardon or your giving me a little bit of, not just a little, but quite a bit of leniency on this. For some of you who probably have not been tracking with this ministry for a long time, you may not have a problem with this at all. As a matter of fact, some of you who have been may not have a problem with it. I may be the only one here that has a problem with it. And really the major problem I have is the problem that I taught it wrongly, and that I taught some very heinous doctrine that was very false doctrine, corrupted doctrine, and doctrine that was some of the most damaging things that I have ever said. And so it's hard not for that to be a personal matter. And because it is, I want to make sure that not only I have it down straight, but that we have it down straight, and that we're not going to make this assumption or this heresy that Jesus died for all the sins of men, and therefore no unbeliever will ever stand in judgment of his sins, and that Jesus died therefore for all the sins but one, the sin of unbelief. And unbelief is the only thing that sends an unbeliever or unjustified man to hell. And that is not true. That is false doctrine, corrupt doctrine of the worst sort, because it actually attacks the very crosswork of Jesus Christ. And if ever I was regretful for any doctrine I have ever taught, that probably is the number one. And for that reason. And so, I guess what I'm asking for is that if you hear things that we kind of go over and go over and go over, it's because I want to make sure that we're clear on it, and would ask your special dispensation. I don't think you're going to fire me. I'm not afraid of that. But I do want it to be clear, and it is fascinating, and it's a fantastic doctrine, and it's a wonderful thing to be liberated from corrupt doctrine and to be able to say that Christ died for every sin, including unbelief. There's no sin he didn't die for, either overlooked or intentionally did not pay the penalty for on the cross. And so to straighten these things out is really an honor and a privilege, and it's not something I shrink from. But I just want to make sure that we're very clear on it. So we have come back to Romans, kind of our base of operations, to make sure that we understand and appreciate as the Apostle Paul is dealing with this, he doesn't teach it here if it's something we need to learn. He presents something about it that we should already know. And so verse 11 again begins this section of doctrine that is going to become the remedy for the tribulation of the gospel that would seek to cause you shame and mouth-shutting effects in the area of the fact that you will never stand in righteous judgment of God at all. You're never going to stand in that righteous judgment that was talked about in Romans 2:5. And this is the second of those two hope issues. So he says, and not only so, and here's the doctrine going to teach you that, or the doctrine to prove that, but we also joy in God through our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom we have received the at-one-ment. And if you don't know what that is, or if that's not producing the joy that should be an expression above and beyond even the rejoicing of what you were doing back in actually verse 2, then you need the doctrine from verses 12 to 21, especially those big conclusions from verses 18 to the end of the chapter. And so he says in verse 12 to begin teaching us this, wherefore as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin. And so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. And it's that last expression in verse 12 that makes what he's going to say in verses 13 and 14 necessary. That all have sinned. Death has passed upon all men, for that all have, past tense, sinned in Adam. It's not that you have personally sinned that's in view here. You have sinned in Adam. And that's your enemy at odds status. And here's how you got it. You didn't get it by becoming a bad person sometime in your life. You didn't get it because one day some girl on a hot summer day walked by you in a bikini and you lusted, and that's when you became an enemy of God. Or when you first took a drink of alcohol, or when you first played poker, or whatever you think that it was. You were that from birth. You were naturally that in Adam. That's the status the one man gave you. And that's what his actions did. His act of sin put him in a legal position so that all that he did could get applied to the many who would come after him. And that would be a bad story and a sad story if it were not that God's grace had provided that another man is going to come along and function in a figure way. And in that figure, he is going to have a one-man status as well. And we'll talk about that figure when we get to it in verse 14. But beginning to explain this, he's going to give explanation, even though it also serves as the opening sentence of a six-statement parenthesis that's to be gathered together into a big piece of information that's all designed to work together. It's a first things first issue. And the first thing to understand the at-one-ment and the joy we should have in it is to understand the one man, Adam, and what his act did and how it got transferred or applied to the many. And that was death passing upon all men, for that all have sinned. Reason, explanation to validate that. For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, verse 14 goes with this. In fact, the parenthesis is going to have two verses, verses 13 and 14, kind of as an introduction. It has its own form. And then you're going to get verse 15 as the first inequality. So you have 13 and 14 kind of go together. 15 stands on its own because it's going to give you an inequality. And that inequality is that even though Adam and Christ are figures, and Adam was a figure of him that was to come, he did not act identical to that. And there's going to be inequalities. And that's why you get, for not as the offense, so also is the free gift. And in verse 16, and not as it was, if the word not is not there, then what he's saying is, these are both equal, but they're not equal. And what we're doing is looking at the status produced by them. The status produced by the one man, Adam, is not equal. In fact, what he had before he sinned is not equal to what Christ produced in his status as one man. And if you took the word, simply just took the word not out of verse 15, but, and then leave the word not there, it says, but as the offense, so also is the free gift. That's saying they're equal. That little word not, which is the Greek word ouk, the strongest single negative in the Greek language, tells you this is unequal, unequal. An inequality is being presented. Same thing in verse 16. You take the word not out, and it's equal. And as it was by one that sinned, so is the gift. But you put the word not, again the word ook in there, and what you have is a huge inequality. But verse 16 needs something further said about it. And that's why in verse 17 you get the further explanatory use of the word for in verse 17. So you have, what I'm trying to give you here is just a little brief outline of the parenthesis. 13 and 14 go together. 15 stands on its own as an inequality. 16 and 17 provide the second inequality. End of parenthesis. So even in those verses 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17, there's a structure to that. It has its own introduction, body, and conclusion to it. It's not a major conclusion because the word therefore isn't used there, but it does do that in verse 17. And so you have 13 and 14, then 15 on its own, 16 and 17. And you have a structure to that as well before these two big punches in the conclusion then are reached in verses 18 through 20. But what I'm after is, again, just to kind of reorient ourselves to this, and as Paul begins dealing with this, he's going to talk about in verse 13, "For until the law, sin was in the world, but sin is not imputed when there is no law." And again, what he's actually after there, of course, is to go to that period of time between Genesis 1:1 and Exodus 19, between the creation and the law. And he's saying something major is different on this side of the law prior to its giving than on this side after it was given. And before the law was given, God was not imputing sins to men. He was not looking at man and imputing his personal, individual sins to him. And one of the things that we want to make sure that we're very clear on is that when we go to this issue of what we commonly have looked at before and wrongly taught, that the debts of men, of unbelievers, are divided into two categories, sins and good works, and that the crosswork of Christ died for all the sins, paid for all the sins, and the sin part is wiped out for men and for believer and unbeliever, that's wrong. That's not biblically accurate. And the only thing that you would stand for is the good works, and of course that's made on a false assumption of what works is in Revelation chapter 20. No credit to, nothing to his credit, and so he's condemned. But what we understand is that biblically, and what I should do is change this actually from sinful debt to sinful works, because that's what the works are. The works are all sin. When the law was brought in, the law began a record-keeping system. And every single sin is written down, and there are certain creatures that are charged with doing that. And again, the concept of having nothing to your credit is true, and since there's no righteousness there, you wind up condemned. I'm showing you a page in the book of works of an unbeliever, and that's what he's got. He has a record of his sins, and that record is not expunged, it is not taken care of at the cross. It does not get dealt with differently because of the cross, either pre-cross or post-cross. It's still going on to this very day. And every unbeliever you know, and this ought to concern you, and every unbelieving member of your family, and every unbelieving friend that you have, they have this record. You did too. And every sin that they have ever committed is going to be put back on them and is going to be imputed to them at the great white throne judgment. And it's not just going to be, I'm going to be kicked into the lake of fire because I rejected Jesus Christ. That's true. But more than that, I have this record against me that I'm going to have to begin paying myself. And hopefully that makes the horror of the lake of fire all that much more horrible in your thinking. Because I certainly know by taking the sin part out of it, at least for one who is presenting the gospel, you've taken one of the major points that is designed to be a weighty, looming, dooming issue out of the equation. And they ought to feel that. They ought to feel the sting of the law and the power of it and the awfulness of it and the full responsibility and accountability for every sin they've ever committed. Every sin they've ever thought, every sin they've ever done, every sin of omission, every sin of commission, all the sin that they have done is recorded. Now, I'm not saying that there's going to be a great big projection screen like this that's going to, you know, go back over their entire life and everything. There doesn't have to be. God is able to get things done in a low-tech manner, and I like that. In fact, the more I live, the more I realize. I guess this happens as you get older, you know, I was really born out of time. I would have liked to have been born in the 40s where I'd have been in the big band era and all that kind of thing. But as I keep getting older, I keep going back in time. And I got thinking, well, it had been really great to have been with Jackson, you know, in the valley and all of this. And now I'm all the way back into the 18th century. I'm thinking I'm just an 18th century guy. I'm certainly not a hip modern pastor because I still wear a tie and I still look like a human being behind the pulpit. And that's the big thing right now, is to look like a slob. The sloppier and slobbier that you can get behind the pulpit, I guess the more people are going to come to hear you because they're slobs too. Well, I'm not going to be sloppy and a slob behind the pulpit. But that's the big thing. I've seen guys who used to wear ties and suits become slobs and look like un-American teenage bums. Not that all teenagers are bums, but I mean the bums that are bums. And I'm not going to do that. I don't care if I'm the only one that wears a tie, I'm still going to do it. Anyway, that's not sin anyway, but this is. All right, we have now gone through quite a bit of information that we should have an appreciation for the issue of the law being an imputer of sin. And we went back to passages in Deuteronomy 4, Deuteronomy 11, Deuteronomy 27, and looked at the cursings that were going to be taking place. Let me get back. See if I can get back here. Well, that's one way of doing it. We'll get back to this. And we went to Mount Ebal, and we saw that what the law did was to establish a way, and what God did with that law, so that all men in general could be indicted by it. And that's a major, major issue that we have been looking at. And we need to substantiate some further things about that law being put up there on Mount Ebal, that Gentile coming up there reading a set of curses that specifically indict him, and which he can go and find the judgments and say, I am cursed of God, worthy of death, and on top of that, I have incurred a debt with that. I'm going to pay for what I've done. And so with that full understanding, or at least a fuller, it's not a full, but a fuller understanding of what it means to be cursed by God, then we need to substantiate some further things regarding the functioning of the law, that it is as a law, and see things regarding the law and its record keeping and what that business is all about. And we need to recognize the reality of that, because that's the mechanical means by which the imputation takes place. The imputation we look at that Paul's talking about here in Romans 5:13, how that takes place. So there's a finalization of the imputation of sin on the unjustified man. And that's going to occur with him at the judgment or the day of reckoning when, now this is a messy chart because there's so many things that I had on it, but what it does do is it shows you, as a matter of fact, I think I actually had that where I took a bunch of this stuff off, but that's okay. You can track with it. The major judgment we're after really is this one here, the great white throne judgment. That's the one spoken of in Revelation 20. But there is another one connected with that that's going to actually take place at the end of the tribulation period. This is when the unjustified unbelievers are going to be judged. And their final destination is going to be the lake of fire. And that's not metaphor, and that's not language of accommodation. That's not anthropomorphisms or pathism. That is a real place. And they're really going to go there, and they're really going to be indebted with, imputed with, every sin, every good work, every part and product and parcel of the energy of their status as the enemy at odds in Adam man they were, and they're going to get it. And that's what the curse is designed to make an impact on in the thinking of that unjustified man. And so that's the finalization of it that's going to take place when he actually begins to suffer the debt and penalty of the whole load of his own sins placed upon him. And there'll be no denying at that time that God exists. Nobody's going to be concerned with whether or not they're going to say God in the Pledge of Allegiance. They're not going to be concerned with whether or not a Bible or its contents gets read anywhere. They're going to realize that's all true. And that they were wrong. And you can, ladies and gentlemen, you can be wrong about a lot of things in life, but you cannot be wrong about that. And while there's many other things, like I say, that we could look at, and all we're doing, there are tons and tons and tons of issues that we haven't even touched upon. And while we've really only begun to develop the issue, we should have covered enough information by now, and I'm not going to review it, and looked at this issue from a biblical, and what we're really interested in is the biblical theology to teach us, not the systematic type, which is false doctrine, but the biblical theology viewpoint. So as far as the historical establishment of the law is concerned, when that law came into being back there, and it's actually getting established in history, up and running, and God doing with it what he did, and that peculiar function of the law for all men in general, we should have at the very least an adequate grasp on that subject. And our basic grasp of the historical entrance of the law and what we've covered about it should go and should prove enough to you the issue that the law functioning toward all men in general and not just exclusively to the nation of Israel really does have the power and ability to impute sin. And we're going to kind of develop that as a final issue now as we go on. So on page 82 of your class notes, we should have an adequate grasp now on the law and its function with all men in general, the law and its historical entrance into the world, and the law and its ability to indict all men as sinners in God's sight. Now, actually, the last two of those major issues we looked at go to produce the proof of the first one. And next we need to look now at how the law actually functions when it functions as an imputer of sin. And again, this is where the wheels fall off of the systematic theology types, and I don't think they all teach that. I think there's a very small segment of that that was my cronies and my crowd that I hung around with and my fellow colleagues, pastors, and things like that that taught that. I don't think this was widely taught. But it was, in my world, it was. It's kind of like, you know, the guy who paints on Saturday. In my world, it's, you know, you have a lovely rock in your world. Well, I had this horrible doctrine in my world. And so maybe I'm making more out of it than I should. I don't know. But that's for me to do because I'm the teacher. Now, really, this is all wrapped up. This issue of the law functioning as an imputer of sin is wrapped up in that issue that we have discussed before and previous to this, that the law is stated and is just exactly that. It is a law. And as a law, the nature that a law has and the two things that we looked at that it has, that's really an understanding of its power and ability to be able to do that. And what I really want to begin looking at in a little more detail is that last issue, that record-keeping issue, because it does exist in other places in the Bible. It is mentioned. And we're going to go over and see a fascinating passage where it's actually talked about by somebody who lived prior to the law. And there was still a record-keeping system. But it's going to validate that issue, that a record-keeping system actually exists in heaven. And I'll tell you who's doing it if you want to know. You probably already know, but I'll show you who's doing the record-keeping system. It's not being done electronically. It's being done by hand. It's being handwritten. So anyway, the ability of the law to function as an imputer of sin is wrapped up in the fact that it is just that, a law. And as a law, it has features to it that this issue of the offenses of sins that are committed against it and are in a violation of it, whereby the imputing of the offense or the sin violation of it to the sin offender. I kind of wrote this up. After I wrote this paragraph, I looked at it, and you know what I thought about? I thought, that's about as confusing as my casebook when I was studying to be an umpire. And when you study to be an umpire, the way we were licensed, you had to study, and go in and take your test. And in Indiana, it was 100 true and false. Used to be, to get into the major leagues, and to begin there, it was 300 false. But for just a high school umpire, it was 100 true and false. You couldn't take any help in there with you. I found out today, and plus, I only got paid like $25 a game. Today, they're getting paid $50 a pop, and when they get licensed here in the state of North Carolina, they get to take their books in with them. The rule book, but the rule book isn't what you really studied. You didn't study the rule book, you studied the case book. It's the case book. And that's why when you go to a law office, you see all of those books, those that are written with all those. They look nice, you know. They kind of have the guy sitting there. He looks very scholarly. It's a great thing to get your picture taken with all those books behind you. Like, I know what's all in here. Pastors are the same way. When you walk into their study, and they haven't read all those books. I haven't read all the books in my study. You know, in fact, there's a whole set of books. There's several sets of books. I've realized I haven't even cracked the things open, and I'm selling them off. Because I don't even use them. They're commentaries, and they're all wrong anyway. And what should I care about what this idiot wrote, even though he made a ton of money on it, you know? I sell it to suckers. I got the best place to get rid of Bible and biblical books and trash you can imagine. All you do is stick the thing up down there at that seminary, and some sucker's going to come along, and they've bought everything I've got. I've not had any trouble getting rid of books. And in that law office, you have all these. That's what those are. Those are case books. This guy versus this guy. Roe versus Wade. Brown versus the Board of Education. Those are very famous cases. Well, in God's system, He also has books. And when I wrote this up, I thought, man, I didn't mean to make this like. But I did have that in mind. That's why I have the offender center. Because like if you study to be going to take the test to be an umpire, you have the batter runner. And the batter runner is different than a runner. The batter runner is the guy who's running from home to first. Once he gets on first, he loses the batter concept. Now he's just the runner. And so when I wrote this, I thought, that's like my old case book. But anyway, if you follow this, if you can, as the law has features to it, that this issue of the offenses or sins that are committed against it, which is what you're doing, you're committing sins against God's righteous standard. And if you put one word with that, you have the law, His legal righteous standard. It's not just His righteous standard as a suggestion, it's His righteous standard as a law and carrying all this weight behind it. And therefore, when the offenses are committed against it, whereby the imputing of the offense, the putting into the account, the writing it down, the record keeping of the offense or sin violation of it, to the offender center. And he's got a record of it the minute he commits it. Don't think that he's going to get that the record exists only when he's going to die, after he's dead, and going to stand in righteous judgment. It's there now. But there's two phases to it for it being fully imputed. But the imputing of the offense to the offending center, these are the natural resulting functions of a law functioning as a law. It happens in any court of our land. It happens in courts that aren't even set up the way our jurisprudence system is set up. In other words, when you're dealing with a law, the imputing of the violation of that law to the offender is the natural part of it. And so when you come along and you want to come along and you want to try and say, well, now wait a minute. When we're in this sinful debt that all gets racked up, that's unfair because of the work Christ did on the cross. Forget that for now, because that's a gross error. Right now, we're concerned with this being the fair thing, because let's take this guy, for instance, Bratsky up here, and let's take the one that he did. Well, let's pick the March 17th, 1980 sin down there, fornication. Now, this is recorded down here so that a witness, this actually functions as a witness against that man. And you can be brought up there and you can say, we have this, not just because it's written in this record, but I'm going to show you in a moment, it was observed. We have actual eyewitnesses to that event. Now, I know you can stand there, as many guys do. You know, they take some guy robs a liquor store, and they have a videotape of him doing it, and they put it up there, and they say, "Is that you?" No. It's not you, huh? Well, we have ways of dealing with that too. But this is the proof that's necessary to satisfy the law. And so therefore, again, it's right here that it's very important to realize that God's law that He gave to Moses that we've been talking about on Mount Sinai, even though He comes along and He chooses to make that law, and again, I want to say this and make sure we're clear on it. I need to get out of here if I can move my mouse. Let me get back to this. All right, on the timeline chart, when we come along here and we talk about the law, it's a very difficult thing. In fact, let me get one up here that's got Israel on it. Let me get, try this one. No. I'm going to get the monkey. Okay, that wake you up. All right, I wanted this one because it is a scaled down, kind of edited version of the timeline chart, but it's got Israel and the Gentiles on here. When the law is given, there is no denying that that law has a special relationship to Israel. In fact, you can come along and you can call this law the Old Covenant. And that's exactly what it is. Now, Paul's going to use terminology that's similar to the covenant. He'll call it an Old Testament and a New Testament. And it wasn't, when God gave it, by the way, they didn't come along and say, "Here's the Old Covenant." He came along and He said, "Here's my law." And when He did, He made that a covenant with the nation of Israel. He didn't call it old at the time, but there came up reason later on for it to be understood that it's going to become old, and there's going to be a new covenant that's going to have to replace that old covenant. But here's what I'm after is this word covenant. The majority of folks who think about the law seem to only be able to think about it in connection with it being a covenant with Israel. And even though I've said this maybe before, I want to cover it just one more time because it's a very important issue. And it's an issue that we have to make sure we're clear on, or we're not going to really get the full weight of what it means for the law to impute sin to everybody, not just to an Israelite. And when God gave that law, He gives the law. He does it with the nation of Israel, but at the same time, He chose to make that a specialized relationship between Him and Israel. And He could do that. And really, that's what a covenant becomes. A covenant is like a special relationship that you have. If you have insurance, you have a special relationship that covenants for, in the case of an accident, money being there to cover the accident. And that insurance policy has lines on it that and words to it that you have read that you should be familiar with, and there's a line on there where you have actually affixed your name. You have signed it. And yet, that may not apply to everybody who, say, owns a car or owns a house or owns a piece of property or owns something that could be insured. They don't necessarily have to insure it. So what I'm after is that God can bring His law in, but He can also choose to make a specialized relationship with only one segment of people where that's concerned. He can legally do that. And so He chose to make it a covenant between Him and Israel. And at the same time, He realized that He did not, nor did He have to establish it with the whole world as a covenant. Because as a law, it has resident within itself the ability to say something about whoever God decides to apply it to. And yet at the same exact time, God doesn't have to describe it as being a special relationship. The Gentiles are far off. They're without God in the world. They're called the uncircumcision. But this is all according to a program God has in view to repossess this earth and establish His kingdom on it. But where sin is concerned, and where all men are concerned, the law has a function to both parties, and it can have a function to both parties, even though one party has a special relationship to it. That's why on Mount Ebal, he can come along and say, put these cursings up there so that when that Gentile reads them, he can identify. Those things, I identify with that. I can't really come along and identify with the cursings in the next chapter. The ones that talk about the, you know, plagues of Egypt coming back on me and all the things that follow the five courses of punishment. That's not what he was to identify with. He was to identify with the cursings that are in there in Deuteronomy chapter 27. And those indicted him. Every one of them was part of his lifestyle, part of his culture. And so that same law, and those are things that all apply to Israel too. But you can see the way in which the law is a law to all, and yet at the same time, God can specifically function with it and covenant with a group of people specifically and exclusively about it. And so he doesn't have to describe it as a covenant. And so resident within that, he doesn't have to have it as something he formally instituted with the Gentiles, that they were necessarily aware of that law being a covenant and signed on to it. They didn't come along thinking, we didn't sign on to anything here. The reason this is important is because in order to really understand the function of its being able to impute sin to all men, you need to see that it is possible and the reality of that possibility simply because this thing that we're dealing with is not called a suggestion, an idea, a good thing, or an opinion, or whatever. It's called a law. An L-A-W. Just give you a good example of this. Let's say, for instance, that this coming break, you decide that you're going to take a trip up to Niagara Falls. You know, you haven't been up there, and you're going to have a second honeymoon at Niagara Falls. And you want to go on the Canadian side. So you're going to have to go into Canada. And so you're going to have to go up there, and you're going to have to cross the border. And when you cross the Canadian border, you're now under an entirely different set of law. And in essence, if you went up to Canada, you don't lose your U.S. citizenship. You're still a U.S. citizen. You're still a U.S. citizen. In other words, even though a Gentile's trotting around on Israel's land, trotting up to a piece of land on a piece of property on Israel's land called Mount Ebal, and trotting up there to look at a law, they may be aliens, but they're under that law. Just as if you, in essence, if you have a covenant relationship with the laws of the United States, and you do, you say, well, I never signed anything. Yes, you did. You signed on to it and keep signing on to it every single time you get a paycheck. Because in your paycheck, deducted out of your, unless you're like Cindy and I think we may be the only exception here, unless you're, I guess, a business owner, but if you're an employee, and you get a check, you don't really even notice it, but there's a place on there called FICA. And money is taken from you at the point of a gun, at the threat of, at the end of a bayonet or a gun. I don't mean at the threat of being killed for it, but at the threat of force of seizing all of your property, your land, your holdings, the government forces you to give it money. Now, I've tried to justify this every way I can, but it still comes out as robbery. The bottom line is, if somebody breaks into my house, puts a gun to my head, and says, fork over your money, that's robbery. I don't see any difference. You say, well, we got to pay for the roads. I'd be glad to do that. You can tax me on horseshoes and on CDs and on computers and on my house and everything else you want to tax me on. I'll be glad to do that. But my money that I earned, I earned. That's robbery. That's being a thief. And so they steal my money from me. So once you have allowed the government to do that, you have actually legally made a contract with the government. I am allowing you to rob from me and steal from me, and I'm saying that's okay because I sign a piece of paper every year called a W-2 or a tax return form. And one of the things, what's the number one thing that every tax preparer in the world keeps telling you? He'll tell you 10 times if he tells you one. Sign it, sign it, sign it. They even, when they give it to you, they got great big arrow sticker things on there. Sign it. Make sure you sign it. If you don't sign it, it's not going to get done. Yeah. So you have entered, put your name on the line into a contractual agreement, a covenant with the laws of the United States of America. And so you have a covenant relationship with our laws, because as a citizen, the laws of the United States uniquely apply and they peculiarly apply to you. Only a U.S. citizen. Now, if you go up to Canada and you're going to go to Niagara Falls and you cross the border into Canadian territory, you now have to function according to their law, Canadian law. I don't even know what Canadian law is. But Canadian law, watch this carefully. Canadian law, let's say God's law, even though it's the Canadians have a particular covenant with it and relationship just as you do with U.S. law, if I go into their land, if a Gentile goes into their land, if I go up to Canada, I have to function under their law. But their law never comes along and says, you're a Canadian. No, the law doesn't say that. It says this law applies to you, but it never says you're a Canadian. And Canadian law says you're an alien. It's just like when we have people from Mexico coming in as illegal aliens into the United States, which we want, evidently. It's something we're crazy about in this country. We love it. We've got big signs down there saying, enter here. You know, we don't give a spit about that problem. And that's by design. That's not being done by accident. That's being done because the federal government wants it that way. If we didn't want it that way, we could do something about it very easily. So we want that. We want the illegal aliens coming into our country. And yet when they come in, our law doesn't come along and say, you're now a U.S. citizen. Yet. I'm sure it will one day. But you are an alien who has entered the country. And when you go into Canada, Canada's law says you're an alien that's entered our country. And while you're here, you're expected to function under Canadian law. They don't come along and expect you to function under U.S. law. They expect you to function under Canadian law. And if you break Canadian law, you're going to be held responsible for that. But there are things within the overall structure of Canadian law that, because you're an alien, you cannot partake of. Just as there's things in U.S. law that, well, see, I have to use Canada because our law, it really is so busted up that it's almost better to be an illegal alien, minority, homosexual, lesbian, with no, you know, because you're going to get money and you're going to get health care and you're going to get all of these things, see. That's the way our country's going. So I'm using Canada really as the better example. And while you're there, you're going to have, the law is going to be functioning towards you, but not certain areas of that law. There's certain areas of that law that do not pertain to you because you're an alien. And you're not in that covenant relationship with Canadian law like Canadian citizens are. For instance, you know that Canada has universal health care. I'm not saying that's a good thing. I'm saying that our system here is so busted up that something's got to be done about it. I don't think that's the right thing, but something's going to have to happen. But if you go up there, for instance, you go up to Canada and you decide, like that one guy I saw recently, to live among the bears. Now, I could have told you, you know, I just talked to you earlier about prognostication. I think I could have told you how that was going to go. And now he became the bear's lunch. See, he got eaten by bears. You live with bears, you're going to be eaten by bears. Now, that even a dummy can figure that out. You see that? Have you seen that guy that lived with the bears? He got ate by the bears, and his girlfriend got ate by the bears. That's because it's a bear. Bears do that. Bears eat people. Well, anyway, I don't know what kind of drug-induced state you have to get yourself in to think you're a bear, but anyway, you're going to go up and you're going to live around the bears. And instead of getting eaten, you just got swiped in the rear end. So you got a gaping hole in your gluteus. And so you go to the Canadian hospital. Well, if you're a U.S. citizen and you get yourself injured up in Canada, you're going to be taken to a Canadian hospital and you're going to get treated there. But you will not be treated under the universal Canadian health care plan. Why? Because you're not a citizen. You're not in that covenant relationship where certain parts of that law have provision for you if you're covenanted with it. And so, if that's the case, you're not going to be treated by their health care plan because you're not a citizen. You don't have that covenant relationship, so you've got to have insurance that's going to pay the bills, because the Canadian government is not going to come along and pay your health care bills. That's going to get imputed to you. That's going to be up to you to take care of. Well, there's holes in all this illustration, but it serves as an illustration to point up that when you're under that law, like Canadian law, because it is a law, it doesn't look at somebody and say, you come into my land and it doesn't apply to you. It applies to everybody there. And because it's the nature of a law to do that. But you're not in a covenant relationship to it, and therefore certain parts of it have nothing whatsoever to do with you. There were certain parts of the law, for instance, no Gentile cared anything at all, and you don't get any of that in those Deuteronomy 27 curses about keeping the Sabbath day. That's something very peculiar to the nation of Israel. There's laws about it. There's even penalties about it. But what we're after is what specifically indicts that man according to his sins and what keeps record of that. And there are certain parts that, since you're out of the covenant, it doesn't have to do with you. And the function of the law that we've been dealing with is just like that. It's a function of the law that, even though God made it in connection with Israel, and is part of what is called the whole book of the law, in which they were in covenant relationship with God, nevertheless, that law has a particular function outside that covenant relationship that functions with others who have no covenant relationship with it, with Gentiles. And therefore, the power and the mechanics by which the law functions as an imputer of sin functions, like I said, simply because it is a law. And in your class notes, we're going to have to stop because we're about out of time. That ability to know what the law is because it's a law, and its ability to impute sin to all men, is a very important thing to understand. Because it's a feature about the law that allows it to function regardless of whether God's program with Israel is in effect or not. And that's why in Romans 5:13, Paul can cite it that way. That's the way and why Paul cites it functioning there in Romans 5:13. And by the way, just to remind you, this also indicated when Paul says what he does later on in 1 Corinthians 15:56. We looked at that passage, we'll go look at it now. But that's why Paul says what he does over there. When he's talking about the issue of death, he says the sting of death is sin and the strength of sin is the law. He doesn't say the strength of sin was the law. That law, being a law, functioning like it did with these guys back here, still doing that work, still making the record, still keeping up, still churning out, cranking out, sin after sin after sin after sin, writing on everybody's record. The strength of sin is the law. Present tense. He doesn't say it was, as if it was that with God's program with Israel when it was in effect and the law was functioning in the sense of that old covenant. No, it still is. It still will be. Do you know that's going to be that way even on throughout that period of time and is still in effect? It will be in effect. And in fact, until... Let me see, I don't know if you're thinking, what's the very last thing that's destroyed? The last thing that goes into the lake of fire? What? Exact. Who said that? Yeah, you're right. Death. Until that happens, and until death itself is destroyed, that's going to be working. Because that's what that produces. And that is that overall universal function of the law, because it's the law. Until death is destroyed and the strength of sin is destroyed, that death is destroyed, that's going to be the status quo. And the imputation of sin is one of those universal functions. Well, we'll stop right there. We'll take our break and we'll come back and start making some headway in our class notes. And we're going to head over to the book of Job. And so when we come back, get ready to go to Job chapter 16. And I'm going to show you that even Job understood the record-keeping system that was in effect. All right, so we'll take our break right now and we'll come back after about 15 minutes and pick it up right here. So go ahead and take your break.